I think in depth with some of these unions myself, because I don't think it's right that I should do so, particularly if he's a subordinate of mine.
And of course you had nobody else out here to talk to.
Right, so I couldn't talk to anybody except when I went somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel, it was again part of my upbringing, that you do not talk about policies as junior officers in a critical manner. Because you're the guy who's supposed to try and straighten it out if it's wrong. And if they're unhappy about it, then as I've just been saying, it is your duty to represent us to higher authority and endeavor to straighten it away. If the answer comes back down the ladder, sorry, no, all you can do is say, sorry, no, down below you. But it's not a matter for discussion and criticism between officers.
You never had senior officers' conferences then?
Yes, we did.
Did you? Mm-hmm. And things like that didn't come up?
I don't believe I ever attended one from here. Naval officers, when the Navy was still the Navy, there used to be an annual senior officers' conference, yes. And I attended as chief of naval personnel, but I don't think we ever had, no, we couldn't have, by the time I came out here, there wasn't a Navy to help. At least the headquarters bit was all lying in shambles on the floor. No, we didn't. But I think, as far as I recall, at those sessions, you did have a certain amount of. But then those sessions would have been closed and there would have been no minutes taken. It would have just been a screaming and yelling match with the chief of the naval staff sitting in the chair and trying to control it. Don't remember such a session, no.
Yeah.
Don't remember one. Maybe I was one. But anyway, where were we? Working up to the final thing, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it really was, as I said, the commanders were sent for by head and told that this is the way it's going to be and so on. For some reason or other, I, for one, chose not to believe him, really. I know I'd heard him say it in very dogmatic terms. But anyway, so back here and really just letting the thing run around in your head and sort of thinking, what do you do next and how do you do it and so on. I don't know when I came to a decision to resign. It was not. See, that was a very traumatic year anyway for us because my wife was extremely ill and so it was a very rough period. So one was pretty fine drawn. And eventually I went to Ottawa for, because we were invited, all of us, to Ottawa for a farewell dinner for the chief of the defense staff, as there, Marshal Miller, who had been fired by Heather in his normal, disgraceful way, but and gave a dinner for him. It was rather sort of Brutus thing. I had already decided when I went up there that this was the time to seek an interview with the minister to tell him what I thought, and so I did, through Admiral Dyer, who was the chief of personnel, who went through the chief of defense staff to make an appointment for me to see the minister. And because this was the way the Navy had already taught me to do it, to go through my divisional officer.
Yes, right.
And so I did. And the dinner was at Rockcliffe, and it was quite a nice affair, and so on. And I had a date with the minister the following day at 1:15 in the house, in his office in the house. And not long before I went up the hill, Lanymore appeared in Dyer's office where I was sitting. And he had not been able to come to the dinner the night before because he'd been down in Norfolk, Virginia, talking to Commander Anti-Submarine Forces Atlantic in the United States Navy about matters of mutual concern. And he'd come up to Ottawa on his way home. And we looked at each other and said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I've come here to resign. What have you come here for? And he said, well, I've come here to resign. And this is the interesting thing to my mind. Neither of us knew the other one was coming. There was no collusion, none whatever. Now, practically, nobody believed that at the time. They sure it was a put-up job, but it was not. We didn't know the other one was going to even be in Ottawa. So he got a date at about 3 o'clock, and I had an after-question period in the house, I suppose, and I had one just before, at 1:15. So I went up to the minister's office, and he greeted me warmly and said that he had a job for me, which I thought he thought I would like to he would like me to go to Washington to relieve Debbie Pierce as the chairman of the joint staff there, and I looked thunderstruck, I guess. And I said, well, words to the effect, it didn't really work out very well, because the reason I had come to see him today was to tell him that I didn't like all this stuff, and I thought that I had better go. So after a fairly lengthy discussion, he told me that all sorts of bright guys thought it was an awfully good idea. For instance, Bomber Harris thought it was good. Well, this is no recommendation to me, because I always thought that Bomber Harris was a clown. And so why would his opinion be germane to Canadian forces anyway? So anyway, the upshot of it was, he said, well, all right, if that's the way you want it, that's the way we'll do it. And I said, when? And he said, well, I don't know. But not just yet, because there are too many things to iron out. And I said, well, you'll let me know, will you? And he said, yes, I will. So we parted, and I went off, and Bill went in, and it was a while later, and they had a real battle, I understand, shouting and yelling and thumping the table and so on. And that was that, and I came back home and said, told my wife, and I didn't tell anybody else, because he'd asked me to keep it under wraps. A little while later, I was at a dinner adventure for the departing captain of the 2nd Escort Squadron, and my flag lieutenant came up to me holding a piece of paper in his hand, so it was white and shaking, and said, is this true? And it was on the PR net, if you please, the public relations officer's teletype had coughed up this piece of paper saying that I was to be superseded in such and such a time by Admiral Charles and so on. Well, I hadn't even told my personal staff, because I'd been asked not to. And naturally, my personal staff were, A, rather put out with me, and B, very upset about the whole thing anyway. Well, the part about being upset with me, they forgot right away, but thank heaven, because they're still my great friends. But it certainly put the cat amongst the pigeons out here, and at about the same time, of course, Lanimore announcement was made too, and O'Brien was to relieve him. And I don't know how this came about. It came about a month ahead of what the minister had led me to believe would be the case, and I think it was a fellow in his organization who just decided to stop horsing around and get on with it. Maybe he's right. I avoided a lot of the press excitement and so on because I went into the Naden Hospital for elective surgery at about that time, and it was fine. They locked the doors and threw away the key and wouldn't let the pressmen in. So it wasn't until I was back on my own ground with my foot in a cast and so on that I had to face the press. So that was a mercy, I think, probably, because they didn't have a chance to dissect me. However, the services sort of seem to keep on going, all right, and I can't really comment on what they're like now because I don't know.
Yeah. When you went to see Hellier, it sounds to me as if he had a pretty fair idea of what you wanted. When you walked in the door and then sort of offered you what he thought was some sort of a plum to see if it...
Well, I don't know. No, I don't know if that's true. No,
it was just coincidental,
Oh, well, the job was coming up because Pierce was resigning. I mean, retiring.
Retiring.
By reason of age.
Mm-hmm.
I think he retired a few months or maybe a year ahead of his compulsory retirement age because he'd completed 35 years of service and why go on working for nothing, as the saying used to be. Maximum pension already payable to him. So that the minister would have been looking around for a replacement for Pierce anyway. So I think that may have been... I don't know, at one time... When he was out here on a visit, one of his thugs sidled up to me and said that the minister was very pleased with the support that I was giving to this program. And I turned around and said, what support? Who told you that? He said, oh, we have our spies, a sort of sly grin. And I can't think what it was I was talking about. Unless it was an interview that I had with a civilian, in fact, the president, national president of the Navy League, who I didn't really... take to, and I didn't really trust very well, but when he was in my office calling upon me, we were talking about this whole thing, and I said something to the effect that if you were an emergent nation setting up services, this was probably the way that you ought to go. Start with one service with three boats and let it go from there. And this may have been reported back to the minister as support mm-hmm. for the thing. Well, it wasn't meant in that sense at all. Is there anything I can think of?
Mm-hmm.
So when I actually arrived in Parliament Hill to talk to him, I don't know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you sort of, I guess in a way, you probably thought about it, that you rather played into his hands by agreeing to go along with the suggestion not to say anything about it for a while, and yet it was the sort of thing that you would naturally do if you were asked by your boss, if you will, to perhaps he couched it in the way for the good of the service, don't say anything yet, or this sort of thing. Kind of would appeal to you.
Yeah, perhaps. I didn't remember that. You may have done. I didn't remember the words. It seemed reasonable to me that this was going to, obviously going to upset things. He needed time to figure out who was going to relieve me. So the request would, please don't talk about it just yet, we'll work it out, it seemed, as a person earlier, some years standing, seemed like a very reasonable request.
It's almost a, not a love-hate relationship exactly, where you had no use for this fellow, and yet you could see that he had made a reasonable request that you went along with, and willingly, apparently. I don't know whether Lantymore did the same.
Only willingly, in that I didn't want the service to be disrupted more than it had to.
Yeah.
And if I went home shouting, saying, I quit, well, you can imagine the conjecture and the excitement and the upset, the bubbling that would have taken place in the fleet.
Yeah, I can see that. And yet that was probably a thing to have done, in a sense.
I don't think so at all. I think I did it right.
I'm saying... For, well, perhaps you did. I don't know. No, you had a slight advantage by saying you're going to do it.
No, I didn't.
No way you weren't going to embarrass.
Oh, yeah, I was going to embarrass him, but that wasn't my consideration.
Yeah.
It's his problem. We shouldn't have started this.
Can't anyway.
No. But when he asked to ask me if I would hold off until he got things straight, he got the organization straightened away, I'd have been awfully surprised if he said anything else.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously had to figure out who was going to be the next Commonwealth pack. And he couldn't do that overnight, I wouldn't think.
No.
So.
No, quite, yeah. No, I can see what you were...
I was thinking of the service.
Yes, right, and right
now. Well, hell, Bell, I'm thinking of the service 34 years.
Yeah.
So how could I suddenly stop because I was talking about clock like heavier?
And in fact, that's why you resigned, because you were thinking of the service.
Yes.
You know, there's no...
In part.
Sure.
Partly for me, too. Indeed. Many people said, why did you do it? Or wasn't it great? Or worse than fact, I said, maybe it was great, maybe it was Danny. It was the right thing for me to do.
Yeah.
Anybody else might have done it something different, but for me, I had to do it.
Yeah.
Well, that's all there was to it.
That's right. And to your credit, too, I feel. I'm fully in sympathy with the idea. Was Lantymore's announced at the same time?
No, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I think so, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
It was certainly very close by, if not exactly. I don't remember the dates now of when the announcements were made. I probably got them at home, but I don't remember.
It seems to me you mentioned something about you had a speech that you had given, but around that time?
Yeah, well, there was a parade at Naden, a command parade, for me to say goodbye to the troops, really, in which I made a speech. And I still haven't found it, incidentally.
Oh, okay.
Matter of fact, I haven't looked at it. It was last week, but I looked for it. I think I might. But it was just the sort of normal, again. I sought to make it a normal departing commander's speech to his people. And I avoided making a great thing out of my resignation and besought them to think carefully for themselves what they should do, not just follow me, not just because I'd gone.
Mm-hmm.
Did I expect them to go and pack up too? In fact, I did not. You see, in the interim, a signal had come from headquarters stating that everybody in the service would have a chance of making up their own mind whether they liked this caper or not, and whether they'd stay on with it or not. That signal has been conveniently lost from historical files, I think, but nevertheless it was there. But because it was encrypted in a high-level code, I couldn't quote it directly, and I couldn't even paraphrase it directly, so I had to talk around it a bit. hasn't been brought up in the communications world with a mind to cryptographic securities, struck me as being a requirement. So, while I covered the subject, it may have left some people a little vague as to what the hell I thought I was talking about. It bothered the press. They didn't understand. They thought I was counseling the troops to do like me and quit, which I wasn't up to. But the people, editorial writer in the Times, really ripped me apart. And funnily enough, on another page of his same newspaper was the account from the reporter who was here, which read a different way entirely. And the editorial writer didn't realize this. And a couple of people around town wrote letters to the editor the following day, pointing it out to him. But never mind. The speech was not aimed at the Victoria Daily Times. It was all aimed at the sailors, mm-hmm. officers and men of the fleet. So, and they got the message all right, so it was all right.
How many senior officers resigned in total?
So Landymore and I, Welland resigned and then unresigned. That's for the electrical, the admiral. I think he left. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
There were others who left at the same time anyway, you see, such as Piers. But as I told you already, he left by reason of age. Reason of age, and there was no point in having a job for one more year or something like that, and he didn't want to stay in Washington any longer. He'd been there long enough. So that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then other jobs opened up in this new hierarchy, as you were saying. The expansion of military political bureaucracy was such that a lot more people got promoted than would have otherwise done.
Yes.
Say nothing of the two people who fell in behind Stirling and Landymore.
Oh, yes.
Both of whom, incidentally, would have been promoted because they were both first-class officers, Charles and O'Brien. But not yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, I'm sure that they would have been promoted anyway.
So what did you do after you had... You went on, you had presumably your retirement leave, and then what happened?
Well, after a bit, I came up here to work, actually. The chancellor of the university asked me if I'd care to try and rehabilitate the University of Victoria Foundation, which had been formed as the Victoria College Foundation. It had been sort of moribund for many years. So I came up here and did that with Floyd Fairclough.
Was that Dick Wilson who did that?
And before I'd been doing that very long, I was at a dinner at Government House given by General Perks, and at which Mr. Bennett, the senior, the premier, was. It was a dinner for Admiral Lord Mountbatten to do with the George Perks Clinic, which I was the fundraising chairman for building the new clinic. And at this dinner, Bennett asked me, said he didn't know what I was doing, if anything, but how would I like to go to London as Agent General? So that's what I did next.
I wouldn't say odd, but it's normally a political plum, that job.
Yes, mostly. Not always. Not always.
No, obviously not always.
Hoffmeister, who was my predecessor but one, was not a political plum.
No, true.
His successor, Fisher, was quasi-political. He was a retiring deputy minister of finance.
Oh, yes, very influential man.
Very influential man.
Years.
It was a prize for him.
Used to scare the hell out of me, quite frankly. I used to go and try and sell him some bonds or stocks. He had to go for bonds for the government.
he was relieved by Westwood, Earl Westwood, who was a minister, so it's political. And then the latest one, Laurie Wallace, which is quasi-political.
Yeah.
He was sort of Mr. Deputy Minister, Mr. British Columbia, and so on. But varied, and for the most part, it was a political appointment, yes, I guess so, in a sense.
Yeah.
In some sense or another. And I think this is actually one of the reasons why Blackie Bennett asked me to go, because it was demonstrably not, and I was demonstrably not a political creature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And therefore, he could not be accused of always giving people... Earl Westwood, since he was not only an ex-minister, he was a failed minister. He failed to get elected and was promptly sent over there. Well, the opposition could grab hold of a thing like that with great glee and denigrate the office of Agent General, which Dennis thought very highly of, quite rightly, I think. But he wanted to bring it back into the public confidence, and I think he thought the one way of doing it was to get somebody who was almost apolitical into the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because after my retirement from the Navy, one woman had the nerve to say that I outrun politics. It was my duty to do so. God. I practically kicked her in My duty, who the hell she was, telling me what my duty was.
Yes, right. Yeah. Dear me.
But still on speaking terms, but only us.
Yeah. After all this time.
I won't mention her name, no. You know her.
Okay. Mm. Oh, dear. So you packed off to London then on this job, and how did you get on there?
Well, it was great fun. I mean, you see, all this time I'd sort of remained very much at arm's length from the Navy. And I did over there, too, because I felt that the manner of my departure was rather apt to be embarrassing to some of my friends who still remained. And lots of CANCOM fleets would come over in Bonaventure and Berth in Portsmouth, and several of them would come up to me and see me in my office and ask me down on board, but I never went. I didn't want to. I think I was wrong, actually. I think I should have gone, but looking back on it, I think that way. At the time, I felt that... Well, in one way, the wounds were too new still, and I was really very upset, and so was my wife, about this whole thing, naturally.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate indeed that Dick Wilson gave me this job here, because he gave me something to grab hold of instead of just sitting around, festering. But anyway, these people would come and see me and ask me, and I never went. And I wish I had now, I say. But even... RN circles, well, I didn't know all that many RN people anymore. The people that I had known who were contemporary with me as sub-lieutenants, many of them had just sort of disappeared or appeared in the London scene from time to time, but it wasn't a circle that the Agent General moved in. One of my friends became the First Sea Lord. Well, that's fine. I used to see occasionally things, but our orbits didn't really coincide at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not difficult to stay clear. Same as the Joint Staff in Canada House, which was largely manned, or frequently was manned by friends in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. I stayed pretty far away from that, too, on purpose. And maybe, again, I shouldn't have, but I did. Until latterly, when a particular friend of Brigadier was the head of it, and who I'd known since before the war, and his wife, who was a local girl here. So we used to play around together and so on, but there was no service business about it. All four of us were all old friends from back in 1938. So it wasn't until really very recently, since I came back here, that I started to being anywhere near the Navy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And now I really don't know what's going on in it, which is the way it probably should be.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. What, this was a semi-diplomatic posting, wasn't it? Sort of halfway there, and your idea was to promote British Columbia interests, trade, and that sort of thing. Could you say something about that?
Really, the simplest capsule of describing the job was that it was sort of a junior high commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
High commissioner for Canada, represented the whole of Canada and everything about it. And the Agents General of the provinces represented their own little piece of it, in particular. And then all the time I was there, the cooperation with Canada House, we received from Canada House and help, was exemplary. We helped each other on frequent occasions. And this was not always so. Apparently, at one stage, High Commissioners and Agents General spat whenever they met, and then really didn't get on at all, but this was not the case all the time I was there. Not because of anything I did. Mm-hmm. Situation had already improved before I got there.
Who was the High Commissioner?
Charles Ritchie, first of all, and then Paul Martin.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Martin,
yeah.
He was still there when I left. Charles I'd known before in the diplomatic corps, but he'd been ambassador in Berlin and to the United Nations and to Washington. I'd happened to meet him, I think, in all those places.
How many provinces had Agents General? Only three or four,
wasn't it? No, it was most of them, yes.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. Manitoba had closed not long before I got there. The Atlantic provinces had one for PEI in New Brunswick and in Nova Scotia, and they found that didn't work because, you know, the poor man was being run by a committee which hardly ever met, and they split it down. New Brunswick had one, Nova Scotia had one, PEI didn't have that one. BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and Quebec And New Brunswick and Nova Scotia when I was there. All had them. New Brunswick closed down just before I left. And that's the way it stands at the moment, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Did you do much traveling?
Down bound, because my parish included the continent too, Europe. So one was taken over there from time to time of various things. And around Britain itself. The title was the Agent General for British Columbia in the United Kingdom and Europe,
mm-hmm.
which is an awful mouthful.
Yeah.
but it was rather very impressive. And I think most of the others had the same sort of fief. Other provinces, Ontario and Quebec, had offices on the continent as well. Some of the rest of us did. I think we should have. I kept saying so, and I think there's every sign that it's going to happen now. A long last. But it didn't work during my time.
You had a staff, of course, of people from the Department of Trade and Industry here, like both in tourism and agriculture?
During my time, yes. Tourism arrived actually after I got there, and halfway through, I suppose, 71, I think it was. And since then, since my departure, the staff had expanded a very large degree.
And I think it's during Laurie Wallace's tenure, and rightly so. I was always crying for more help, but I never got it. I think he, with his vast experience of government here, knew the right tap to turn,
mm-hmm.
which person to talk to, which I never did discover.
That's getting himself some support back
exactly.
in Victoria.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Different sort of thing we were really talking about in respect to the
Indians.
Yes,
indeed, yes.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
It just demonstrates that something succeeds like personal contact.
Yeah. Well, now, and I guess that's what your job was all about, wasn't it? As the agent general yourself, I mean, did you act? Actually sort of negotiate with anybody, or were you...
No, front man, really.
You're strictly the front man, yeah. Sort of PR and, yeah. and greeting people and...
That's it.
That
if you're opening doors, you could open doors, and this is interesting enough, too. When before I went over there, there was a great discussion in the Premier's office whether I should be called Rear Admiral Stirling or Mr. Stirling, and I was rather surprised. I stayed neutral then as much as I could, because I wanted them to tell me what they thought. And it was the same decision as had happened in the Chancellor's office at UVic. Eventually it was decided that it would use the rank, it would open more doors than it would close, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed it was true, in Britain particularly. Well, and in Europe.
I would have thought that would have been a natural, and I'm a little surprised that all these people sat down and agonized over it a bit. Too.
Well, I brought it up, you see, because I thought, well, you know, there's many civilians, and particularly politicians and bureaucrats are very egalitarian kind of people. Except when it affects themselves directly.
Yeah.
but they are not one to tolerate rank and title.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I do not want to give the impression that I am railroading my rank into this thing and that I want to use it particularly. So I asked the question. And they more or less threw it back at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I kicked it back. We kicked the ball around for not very long, but there was a great consideration given to him. And it came out this way, and I'm sure it was the right decision.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then when Debbie Pierce subsequently went over there as the Agent General for Nova Scotia some time after I'd left, the circles we dealt with were accustomed to having naval officers in this circuit, and I gather it didn't do him any harm at all that I'd broken the ice for him.
No.
Were there any major... coups that you might have swung over there at all in any way?
We were at a period when it was a very strange period, really, of trade and industry. Trade and Industrial Development and Commerce was the name of that department at the beginning when I first went over there, which is an awful mouthful. Anyway, they were short-staffed and ill-staffed. They were still growing, and they'd got to a stage where a lot of people had retired in the higher levels of the bureaucracy, and they hadn't been training people to come up, and they were in a mess. It was after I got over there and when changes started to be made here, and that department was suddenly realized to be a very important one and should be properly staffed from the deputy minister on down. Well, they had a couple of deputy ministers. One was not a success, and one is still there and is apparently a success. And the staffing, they went out and got people. They brought them in from industry, they brought them in from everywhere, which is what they should have done years before.
It was run on the old boys, the old-fashioned civil service basis,
split between them is not particularly well worth unless you're going to sweep your way through the week. So, not to say there weren't some good men, there were, but they were swamped by the, time service. So when this great light dawned and they started to do things, this brightened things up over in Europe considerably. But we had a funny anomaly too, and I don't know if they still have it, that many British Columbia manufacturers and producers have the same feeling about exports that a lot of the Brits have. That my product is so good that I don't need to push it, somebody will come and ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we excoriated the British for this for many years, for not advertising and not telling you how good Rolls Royces are, or Wilkinson Steel, or Little Widgets or something, because they are excellent, but if only they tell people, they tell a whole lot more, and couldn't have bothered. Same thing at that time obtained regarding British Columbia manufacturers. They couldn't be bothered. This export market was a screen for their product in Europe, particularly. They couldn't be bothered. We're selling enough here and in Oregon and Washington and so on. So don't bother me. Amazing, but true.
Hmm.
So they rejuvenated the Department of Industry and Industrial Development Commerce. They changed the name, didn't they? Really, when they went to work, they found that things were, there were lots of things for them to do, and I believe they managed to do some of it too. Certainly, spreading in all directions. So I think they must be successful. They've got people off their foot and butts, and they get them doing, which they couldn't do it. I don't know why. I think it's a sort of a bureaucratic backup, is not that
correct? Were you ever involved in anything to do with the establishment of new industries in D.C.? Europeans wanted to come here at all?
Yeah, well, a certain amount. This is where we played a sort of entrepreneurial role. Together with the banks, the Canadian banks were very helpful indeed, particularly in Germany,
mm-hmm.
In Frankfurt, which is also the financial capital of Germany. The Canadian banks, they were really good, gung-ho people, and they did a lot of good stuff. And they would use us as the shoehorns or as entrees if it wasn't suitable to go through their bank, and sometimes it wasn't to go through the Bank of Commerce, for instance, here in Victoria. It was better to go through the government and get a government seal of approval on the project before the thing took off. Yeah, Trim was involved in this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one particular seminar in Frankfurt, sponsored by one of these banks, which is a very successful affair, and they can produce a whole bunch of interesting inquiries. Some of which were also approved and some of which didn't. There's a very interesting evening,
yeah,
I'm telling you.
Right.
We had a fellow over from here, myself and somebody else who made speeches, and we spied in mid-age and
yeah,
stuff. It was quite well done.
Do you have any particular problems with your political masters, if you will?
Not really. Well, only the ones that I said, and I kept saying, you must have more people over here.
Yeah.
You must have people in Europe. And I didn't. But I'd say this to Bennett every time I saw him, and he'd say, yes, 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 and nothing would happen. And in his day, there was no point talking to anybody else about such things.
No.
He was going to hit or not good.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who was going to say it.
Yeah.
And sometimes pay and allowances. I was very upset about the pay and allowances one of my officers couldn't get. And I attacked him on it one day. And he just grabbed me aside and took brush aside. I wouldn't listen to him. So.
Hmm.
And this is one of his blank spots. But he is there once again. Everybody turned on everything possible for him. And he had an handy time, he loved it, great time, and did a lot of very useful talking, too. And he was a very skillful fellow at it. But if he didn't want to listen to me, he just didn't listen to me. And suddenly, I wanted to see to increase the staff in London just a little bit, in order that some of them could do a lot of investigative travel, trade in inquiry stuff in Europe, particularly in Germany. And Germany, continentally, was the place where I thought the most meaningful for us. And probably having done that for a year or so, you would be in a position to say, well, we should have a European office in Strasbourg because it's convenient in all directions, or Frankfurt, or somewhere. And then it would be the time to consider opening an office there. Terribly expensive, but maybe that. So, I almost got approval of this. I almost got him to agree that this was a good idea. Yes, he did. Yes, he did agree that this was kind of like the way to go. Result? No.
No.
No, it is.
That wasn't in the cards at that moment.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This appointment, presumably, was at pleasure, as they say. How did it end for you?
Well, it started as a 3-year thing, and I asked him when he asked me if I'd like to go, and I basically said yes. I said eventually because I didn't jump at it. Actually, I wanted to think about it. I wasn't sure what it meant. Anyway, eventually I agreed, and asked him how long. He said, how about 3 years? And I said, well, 3 years is barely enough, because I know in the first year you won't know what you're doing, in the second year you'll remember, and in the third year you probably do.
Okay, we'll go back again now. You were discussing, you were leaving the job, or you were getting a job, 3-year appointment.
Yeah, right, right. And I said, well, I didn't figure, I think 3 years was barely enough. So you're in touch with the news. He said, well, let's leave it, say, 3 years, and we'll see what happens. And that seemed all right, so we did. And asked her about 3 years, and I said, well, what do you want me to go on, or want me to stop? I'm prepared to stay if you want me to. And so he said, well, why don't you stay 10 years? And I said, no. How could anybody want to stay here for 10 years? But anyway, he said, all right, well, just go on. Let me know if you want to stop. Well, then, of course, Barrett and his crew were elected. And I asked him if he wanted me to stay on. He said, sure. So I did. And actually, he came over a couple of times on one of his visits. I said, look, we ought to talk about how much longer do you want me to stay? And he said, well, I don't want you to go. But, you're doing fine as far as I'm concerned. So I said, well, I think we ought to sort of start thinking about terminating, which is, after all, enough sort of thing. So I picked my 60th birthday, in fact. He said, how about retiring a little of 1975? I said, all right. So that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. So in fact, you had enough for...
Yeah, 6¾ years.
Yeah, that's plenty.
Yeah, that's plenty, and that sort of thing. And of course, it was far the longest that we had ever lived anywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You really thought you had roots down there,
yeah.
I suppose.
Well, people began to say, well, I thought you were going to retire over here, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I guess we had got brainwashed to quite an extent, but no, we owned a house here, and we wanted to come back, and this was home, and so on. So back we came.
The relations with Barrett were perfectly friendly and normal.
Oh, very, very. I got on very well with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously he was happy with you.
Well, I think he was, I guess. And I got on very well with him and most of his cabinet when I came over. Well, most of them were, they didn't know anything about the great wide world. And so I was able to help quite a lot. So therefore that was good.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
So we didn't, all his ministers and I didn't see eye to eye. All. But well, that's the same with the other outfit too. I know. So, just a minute. The other outfit is the same.
Well, we seem to be at the end of the tape, and I suppose really the end of the interview. Pretty well handled your career, I think. And thank you very much for coming along and spending so much time with me, because it's a most interesting account.